I have often been asked how the opening scene of Chariots of Fire came about, if it had been derived from any other source, if only because British Olympic teams didn't have training camps until about 50 years later. And even when they did occur, it was unlikely that our team would have collectively splashed through the waves in their training. My answer is that the credit scene came as a direct product of Colin Whelan's love of the Olympic baton relay sequence in Leni Riefenstahl's magnificent film Olympia of the 1936 Olympic Games, showing a young Greek runner holding his baton high, striding through the waves. And I had showed it to Colin because that sequence had continued to inspire me throughout my life in sport. Of course, our opening sequence was massively enhanced by the music of the Greek composer Vangelis, though neither I or any of the cast were to hear it until the film opened a year later. It all took place on a cold, windswept beach in St. Andrews on April the 28th and 29th, 1980, with our actors scattered amongst a pack of athletes from St. Andrews University. St. Andrews, I can almost hear you say? But I thought it was supposed to be Broadstairs in Kent. No, that is where poetic license comes in. So no, there was no 1924 Olympic training camp, and therefore no Broadstairs. It took 2 days and dozens of takes in that bitter east wind to get those unforgettable images in the can. Then it was off to Crieff Hydro with our Chariots battalion to film our Highland Games sequence, in which Eric Liddell would be introduced. And yes, when we arrived at the Games field 2 days later, it was just as my pathetic little drawing had suggested, as the film's set designers had produced a perfect copy. Yes, there it all was, the two mountains above the meandering stream, the dancing platform, the pegged grass track, the competitors' tents, even the cows in the adjoining field. Yes, it was all exactly as I'd imagined. We were now ready to go. That first morning, the population of Crieff arrived in their droves. Their athletic brothers and sons have been recruited to jump and throw, or even race in the 220-yard handicap, in which our man Eric would provide the athletics world with that first hint of his talent. That was fine, but my immediate concern was that the cameraman did not appear to be filming the rich diversity of a Highland Games. It's throwing, it's jumping, it's dancing, it's piping. I pointed this out to Hugh Hudson, but he did not appear to be unduly concerned. But my moment of triumph, that was yet to come, in Ian Charlson's address to the assembled crowd. For, a few minutes into it, in the adjoining field there was suddenly, as if on cue, the loud moo of a cow. Ever the actor, Ian grinned, paused, and continued to address his audience. It was a truly magic moment, though my request for some tangible recognition for my cow was ignored. Then on trundled our ragged regiment to Edinburgh, to Goldenacre, home of Heriot's Rugby Club, and the site of my first athletic success in triple jump way back in 1951 at the Scottish Schools Championships. Here we would produce a magic moment in Eric Liddell's athletics career, when in a 440-yard race against Irish runners, he'd been knocked over at the first curve, had got back onto his feet and won the race. But strangely, for no good reason, now the race was to be against the French. Thus, every time I lecture in France, I'm invariably denounced by indignant Frenchmen, rightly claiming that they were guiltless. Indeed, one even observed that a week before, an Irish tug-of-war team had been disqualified for pushing. But this was the way it was to be, and I'd appointed Ron Sylvester, a leading Highland Games sprinter, to give Ian Charlson a wee dunt on the first curve. This would be no problem for Ron, as there were no lanes on bumpy Games tracks, and 220-yard sprints were there for a full contact sport. "He'll go down, Tom," he said. "I promise you that." "Aye, Ron," I said, "but just you remember that he's got to get up. Ian's got the Olympic Games in a couple of weeks." It is at this point worth mentioning that my own skills as an actor had not gone unnoticed, because I had been appointed as official starter in this memorable race. Indeed, I'd even been given responsibility for two lines of dialogue. Those two unforgettable lines were, "Gentlemen, get to your marks." I had sneakily added the word gentlemen. "Get set." Pause. Then I would fire the starting pistol. "Action, Tom," shouted Hugh Hudson, and I walked forward towards Ron and his colleague. The two men were now stripped off, but both now wore black berets. "Who on earth told you to wear these berets?" I asked. Ron Sylvester pointed towards Hugh Hudson. I strode over to Hugh. "Why don't you go all the way with these lads?" I said. "What do you mean, Tom?" "I mean, why don't you just give the pair of them onions round their necks and a bicycle? This is supposed to be a really moving moment in the film. But you're going to have Eric running past two guys wearing hats. They'll be falling all over themselves from here to Chattanooga." So off came the berets, and on went the race. It had all turned out well, but behind my aggressive approach to Hugh Hudson had been the words of David Putnam after the Highland Games. He had heard that my advice to Hugh on the lack of field events had been ignored. "No, Tom, let me make this completely clear," he said. "If you have any problems in the future with Hugh, then just you come to me, and you will win the argument. You are in charge of the film's athletic content." So now I was on top of the world. I was somebody. But then, alas, out of the blue came a crushing blow to all my hopes of a thespian career. Because, with the day's filming now over, I immediately ripped off my sticky moustache and threw it to the ground. The props lady was almost immediately at my side. "No, no, don't do that, Tom," she said. "Your moustache, it's worth £80. £80. And I had been paid a mere £17 for my one-take performance. My moustache had been worth four times as much as me. So our chariot's caravanserie now moved on to its last major port of call, a dishevelled cinder track in the Wirral. This was now to serve, in its declining years, as the Stade Colombe Paris, the site of the 1924 Olympic Games. Strangely, my first practical task was to correct the spelling on the shop fronts at the stadium. For lacking the benefits of a Scottish education, Hugh Hudson had failed to notice several spelling errors, which I duly corrected at no cost. But first we had to find our stadium crowds, and we drew at £10 a day from the population of Liverpool, daily shuffling them around the stadium in order to give the impression of a packed Olympic arena. But those were pre-digital days, when we filmed the terrace-free back straight. No one in the crowd ever moves a muscle, because what is there is a painted still. But correction of French spelling was soon to prove to be the least of my problems, for two American actors had now arrived, Dennis Christopher, playing Charlie Paddock, and Brad Davis as Jackson Schultz, and it was my immediate task to train these two men in 4 days for an Olympic 100-metres final. Alas, Charlie Paddock had been a chunky, muscular athlete with muscles in places where Dennis Christopher did not even have the places. Putnam's American partners, deploying some strange logic, had insisted on Dennis Christopher merely because he had recently starred in another sports movie, the cycling-based film Breaking Away. Brad Davis, on the other hand, he was a stocky little actor who had recently appeared in a film called Midnight Express as a young American drug dealer festering in a Turkish jail. And clearly meaning business, Brad had travelled the 3,000 miles to Liverpool, carrying in his suitcase 2 20-kilo dumbbells. My first session with Christopher and Davis proved to be a nightmare, because both men, though polite, proved to be strangely remote, and I seriously considered employing a medium for assistance. That evening, David Putnam asked me how my first session had gone, and I informed them that it had been little short of disastrous. He did not seem to be too surprised. He said, "let me have a few words with them tonight at the hotel." Next day's session went like a dream. True, neither man would, even with the wind behind him, ever be likely to break 15 seconds for 100 metres, but no matter, they would both in a few days be ready for their Olympic final. I then met with Putnam and asked him to tell me what the problem had been. "Drugs," he immediately replied. "Cocaine. They've already been kicked out of the hotel for assaulting some of the guests. We were now ready for the Olympic 100 metres final, and apart from making sure that Hal Abrams won it, my aim was to make it look real. This meant that my three athletes from Liverpool Harriers had to look as if they were running flat out against actors about 4 seconds slower than them. They did very well, aided by head-on shots, which did not make it clear that they were gaining on my actors with every stride. That, and the fact that in their 30-metre sequences I had given each of my three actors head starts of over 4 metres. Here, my sole aesthetic, oblique technical contribution to the film was in the pre-race tunnel shot from behind Abrams to show the essential focus of the sprinter to run as if in a tunnel, ignoring his competitors on either side. One of the many fictions of Chariots was that Abrams' coach, Sam Musubini, was, as a professional, denied entry to the Olympic Stadium. But as a result, we had a scene in which he was shown sequestered in a hotel bedroom as the Olympic 100 metres final was being held. In Colin Whelan's original script, Sam had, on hearing the national anthem, gleefully launched a pint of beer, Cossack style, into the fire. But I had scored this out with the words, "No, fist through hat." And so it was to be. But my problems were still far from over. I had, from the outset, made the point that an Olympics without field events was rather like an opera without music. My solution was to bring a small group of my decathletes up from London to jump and throw. Impossible, said Putnam, because the film's meagre £3 million budget, already stretched to its limits, would not allow it. Better, therefore, that I deploy members of Liverpool Harriers, who had already featured in the Olympic March Past and in the 100 metres final. And so, it was now my task to locate, from a bunch of linear Harriers, every one of them simply a pair of legs with a head on top, a thrower to compete in the 1924 Olympic Games. This would ultimately prove to be a task both difficult and dangerous, even life-threatening, although that did not occur to me at the time. But it was something that had to be done, and in short order. Otherwise, the Paris Olympic Games of 1924 would feature not a single field event, and that had to be avoided at all costs, deploying the services of my redoubtable squad of Liverpool Harriers.
Next, of course, he's heading towards the Oscars.